Sometimes they travelled together, when Moses was invited to speak to some important group or to meet representatives of a foreign power. They went to Sheffield and Oxford to address elements from opposite ends of the political spectrum, the British Communist Party and the Association of Conservative Students. One weekend, they flew to Paris to meet with officials from the French Directorate of Foreign Affairs, and a month later, they even went to Moscow together. Tara travelled on her British passport and spent the days sightseeing with her Russian in-tourist guide, while Moses was closeted in secret talks in the offices of the Fourth Directorate overlooking the Gorky Prospect. When they returned to London, Moses and some of his exiled fellow South Africans organised a protest rally in Trafalgar Square, directly opposite the imposing edifice of South Africa House, with its frieze of animal head sculptures and colonnaded front entrance. Tara could not join the demonstration, for Moses warned her that they would be photographed with telescopic lenses from the building, and forbade her to expose herself to the racist agents. She was far too valuable to the cause. Instead, she struck upon a delightfully ironic twist and telephoned the High Commissioner. He invited her to lunch again. She watched from his own office, sitting in one of his easy chairs in the magnificent stinkwood-panelled room, while below her in the square Moses stood beneath a banner, "Apartheid is a crime against humanity," and made a speech to 500 demonstrators. Her only regret was that the wind and the traffic prevented her hearing his words. He repeated them to her that evening as they lay together on the hard mattress on the floor of their bedroom, and she thrilled to every single word. One lovely English spring morning they walked arm in arm through Hyde Park, and Benjamin threw crumbs to the ducks in the Serpentine. They watched the riders in Rotten Row and admired the show of spring blooms in the gardens as they passed them on their way up to Speaker's Corner. On the lawns, the holiday crowds were taking advantage of the unseasonable sunshine, and many of the men were shirtless, while the girls had pulled their skirts high on their thighs as they lolled on the grass. The lovers were intertwined shamelessly, and Moses frowned. Public displays of this kind offended his African morality. As they arrived at Speaker's Corner, they passed the militant homosexuals and Irish Republicans on their upturned milk crates and went to join the group of black speakers. Moses was instantly recognised. He'd become a well-known figure in these circles, and half a dozen men and women hurried to meet him. All of them were coloured South African expatriates, and all of them were eager to give him the news. "They have acquitted them? They have set them all free? Nokwe, Magatu, Nelson Mandela, they are all free? Judge Rumpf found every one of them not guilty of treason." Moses Gama stopped dead in his tracks and glowered at them as they surrounded him, dancing joyfully and laughing in the pale English sunlight, these sons and daughters of Africa. "I do not believe it," Moses snarled angrily, and somebody shoved a crumpled copy of the Observer at him. "Here, read it. It's true." Moses snatched the newspaper from him. He read swiftly, scanning the front page article. His face was set and bleak, and then abruptly he thrust the paper into his pocket and shouldered his way out of the group. He strode away down the tarmac pathway, a tall, brooding figure, and Tara had to run with Benjamin to catch up with him. "Moses, wait for us!" He did not even glance at her, but his fury was evident in the set of his shoulders and the fixed snarl on his lips. "What is it, Moses? What has made you so angry? We should rejoice that our friends are free. Please speak to me, Moses." "Don't you understand?" he demanded. "Are you so witless that you do not see what has happened?"
I don't. I'm sorry."
"They have come out of this with enormous prestige, especially Mandela. I had thought that he would spend the rest of his life in prison, or better still, that they would have dropped him through the trap of the gallows."
"Moses," Tara was shocked, "how can you speak like that? Nelson Mandela is your comrade."
"Nelson Mandela is my rival until the death," he told her flatly. "There can only be one ruler in South Africa, either him or me."
"I do not understand."
"You understand very little, woman. It is not necessary that you should. All you must learn to do is obey me." She annoyed and irritated him with her perpetual moods and jealousies. He found it more difficult each day to accept her cloying adoration. Her soft, pale flesh had begun to revolt him, and each time it took more of an effort to feign passion. He longed for the day that he could be rid of her. But that day was not yet. "I'm sorry, Moses, if I have been stupid and made you angry." They walked on in silence, but when they came back to the Serpentine, Tara asked diffidently, "What will you do now?" "I have to lay claim to my rightful place as the leader of the people. I cannot allow Mandela to have a clear field." "What will you do?" she repeated. "I must go back. Back to South Africa." "Oh, no," she gasped. "You cannot do that. It's too dangerous, Moses. They will seize you the minute you set foot on South African soil." "No," he shook his head. "Not if I have your help. I will remain underground, but I will need you."
"Of course, whatever you want. But, my darling, what will you hope to achieve by taking such a dreadful risk?"
With an effort, he put aside his anger and looked down at her. "Do you remember where we first met? The first time we spoke to each other?" "In the corridors of the Houses of Parliament," she answered promptly. "I'll never forget." He nodded. "You asked me what I was doing there, and I replied that I would tell you one day. This is the day." He spoke for another hour, softly, persuasively, and as she listened, her emotions rose and fell, alternating between a fierce joy and a pervading dread. "Will you help me?" he asked at the end. "Oh, I am so afraid for you. Will you do it?" "There is nothing I can deny you," she whispered. "Nothing." A week later, Tara telephoned Santan at Rhodes Hill and was surprised by the clarity of the connection. She spoke to each of the children in turn. Sean was monosyllabic and seemed relieved to surrender the telephone to Gary, who was solemn and pedantic in his first year at business school. It was like talking to a little old man, and Gary's single topic of original news was the fact that his father had at last allowed him to start work part-time as an office boy at Courtney Mining and Finance. "Pater's paying me £2.10 a day," he announced proudly, "and soon I'm to have my own office with my name on the door." When his turn came to speak to her, Michael read her a poem of his own, about the sea and the gulls. It was really very good, so her enthusiasm was genuine. "I love you so much," he whispered. "Please come home soon." Isabella was petulant. "What present are you going to bring me?" she demanded. "Daddy bought me a gold locket with a real diamond." And Tara was guiltily relieved when her daughter passed the telephone back to Santan. "Don't worry about Bella," Santan soothed her. "We have had a little confrontation, and Mademoiselle's feathers are a wee bit ruffled." "I want to buy a coming-home present for Shaza," Tara told her. "I have found the most gorgeous medieval altar that has been converted into a chest. I thought it would be just perfect for his cabinet office at the house. Won't you measure the length of the wall on the right of the desk, under the Pernieff paintings? I want to be certain it will fit in there." Santan sounded a little puzzled. It was unusual for Tara to show any interest in antique furniture. "Of course I will measure it for you," she agreed dubiously. "But remember, Shaza has very conservative tastes. I wouldn't choose anything too..." She hesitated delicately, not wanting to denigrate her daughter-in-law's taste. "Too obvious or flamboyant." "I'll phone you tomorrow evening," Tara did not acknowledge the advice. "You can read me the measurements then." 2 days later, Moses accompanied her when she returned to the antique dealer in Kensington High Street. Together, they made meticulous measurements of both the exterior and interior of the altar. It was a truly splendid piece of work. The lid was inlaid with mosaic of semi-precious stones, while effigies of the apostles guarded the four corners. They were carved in ivory and rare woods, and decorated with gold leaf. The panels depicted scenes of Christ's agony, from the scourging to the crucifixion. Only after careful examination did did Moses nod with satisfaction. Yes, it will do very well. Tara gave the dealer a bank draft for £6,000. Price is Shaz's yardstick of artistic value, she explained to Moses while they waited for his friends to come and collect the piece. At £6,000 he won't be able to refuse to have it in his office. The dealer was reluctant to hand the chest over to the three young black men who arrived in an old van in response to Moses' summons. It's a very fragile piece of craftsmanship, he protested. I'd feel a lot happier if you entrusted the packing and shipping to a firm of experts. I can recommend... Please don't worry, Tara assured him. I accept full responsibility from now on. It's such a beautiful thing, the dealer said. I would simply curl up and die if it were ever scratched. He wrung his hands piteously as they carried it out and loaded it into the back of the van. A week later, Tara flew back to Cape Town. The day after the crate cleared customs in Cape Town docks, Tara held a small but select surprise party in Shaz's cabinet office to present him with her gift. The Prime Minister was unable to attend, but three cabinet ministers came, and with Blaine and Santon and a dozen others crowded into Shaz's suite to drink Bollinger champagne and admire the gift. Tara had removed the rosewood Georgian sofa table that had previously stood against the panelled wall and replaced it with the chest. Shaza had some idea of what was in store. Santon had dropped a discreet hint, and of course the charge had appeared on his latest statement from Lloyd's Bank. £6,000? Shaza had been appalled. That's the price of a new Rolls. What on earth was the damned woman thinking of? It was ridiculous buying him extravagant gifts, for which he paid himself. Knowing Tara's tastes, he dreaded his first view of it. It was covered by a Venetian lace cloth when Shaza entered his office, and he eyed it apprehensively as Tara said a few pretty words about how much she owed him, what a fine and generous husband, and what a good father he was to her children. Ceremoniously, Tara lifted the lace cloth off the chest, and there was an involuntary gasp of admiration from everyone in the room. The ivory figurines had mellowed to a soft buttery yellow, and the gold leaf and the royal patina of age upon it. They crowded closer to examine it, and Shaza felt his unreasonable antipathy towards the gift cool swiftly. He would never have guessed that Tara could show such taste. Instead of the garish monstrosity he had expected, this was a truly great work of art. And if his instinct was correct, which it almost always was, it was also a first-class investment. "I do hope you like it," Tara asked him with unusual timidity. "It's magnificent," he told her heartily. "You don't think it should be under the window?" "I like it very well just where you put it," he answered her, and then dropped his voice so nobody else could overhear. "Sometimes you surprise me, my dear. I'm truly very touched by your thoughtfulness." "You too were kind and thoughtful to let me go to London," she replied. "I could skip the meeting this afternoon and get home early this evening," he suggested, glancing down at her bosom. "Oh, I wouldn't want you to do that," she answered quickly, surprised by her own physical revulsion at the idea. "I'm certain to be exhausted by this afternoon. It's such a strain." "So our bargain still stands? To the letter?" he asked. "I think that's wiser that way, don't you?" Moses flew from London directly to Delhi and had a series of friendly meetings with Indira Gandhi, the president of the Indian Congress Party. She gave Moses the warmest encouragement and promises of help and recognition. At Bombay, he went on board a Liberian-registered tramp steamer with a Polish captain. Moses signed on as a deckhand for the voyage to Lorenzo Marques in Portuguese Mozambique. The tramp called in at Victoria in the Seychelles Islands to discharge a cargo of rice and then sailed direct for Africa. In the harbour of Lorenzo Marques, Moses said goodbye to the jovial Polish skipper and slipped ashore in the company of five members of the crew who were bound for the notorious red-light area of the seaport. His contact was waiting for him in a dingy nightclub. The man was a senior member of the underground freedom organization, which was just beginning its armed struggle against Portuguese colonial rule. They ate the huge, juicy Mozambique prawns, for which the club was famous, and drank the tart green wine of Portugal, while they discussed the advancement of the struggle and promised each other the support and assistance of comrades. When they had eaten, the agent nodded to one of the bar girls, and she came to the table and, after a few minutes of arch conversation, took Moses' hand and led him through the rear door of the bar to her room at the end of the yard. The agent joined them there after a few minutes, and while the girl kept watch at the door to warn them of a surprise raid by the colonial police, the man handed Moses the travel documents he had prepared for him, a small bundle of second-hand clothing, and sufficient escudos to see him across the border and as far as the Witwatersrand gold mines. The next afternoon, Moses joined a group of 100 or more labourers at the railway station. Mozambique was an important source of labour for the gold mines, and the wages earned by her citizens made a large contribution to the economy. Authentically dressed and in possession of genuine papers, Moses was indistinguishable from any other in the shuffling line of workers, and he went aboard the third-class railway coach without even a glance from the uninterested white Portuguese official. They left the coast in the late afternoon, climbed out of the muggy tropical heat, and entered the hilly forests of the Lowveld to approach the border post of Komatipoort early the following morning. As the coach rumbled slowly over the low iron bridge, it seemed to Moses that they were crossing not a river, but a great ocean. He was filled with a strange blend of dismay and joy, of dread and anticipation. He was coming home, and yet home was a prison for him and his people. It was strange to hear Afrikaans spoken again, guttural and harsh, but made even more ugly to Moses' ear because it was the language of oppression. The officials here were not the indolent and slovenly Portuguese. Dauntingly brisk and efficient, they examined his papers with sharp eyes and questioned him brusquely in that hated language. However, Moses had already masked himself in the protective veneer of the African. His face was expressionless and his eyes blank, just a black face among millions of black faces, and they passed him through.